You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 12th of November 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, from the thumbs up to Putin to dodging Macron's peace forum, how this week's armistice ceremonies exposed Donald Trump's feeling towards a traditional world order. Also coming up, we reveal the winner of this year's Monocle Soft Power Survey. And bravo à la France.
He is also a believer in soft power, and he's also a believer in that France can do good in the world and that French culture is something to be championed and to be celebrated at this point.
And from soft power to soft fruit, why South Korea's decision to export tangerines to the north is so important. All that plus the Asian newspapers too. That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And a very warm welcome to Studio One. 31 people are now known to have died, and 200 are still missing in the worst wildfires California has seen for decades. In fact, the death toll now equals that of the Griffith Park bushfire dating back to 1933. Well, Daniel Wolfe is from Quartz, and he joins me on the line now. Daniel, welcome to Monocle 24. Can you bring us up to date with the latest figures, please?
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me. So far the Camp Fire has burned over 113,000 acres. It's much larger than San Francisco itself, where it's burning about 100 miles north of there. And then further south of the state at the Hill and Woolsey Fire, that's a combined 95,000 acres. And both fires around 20% contained at this point.
Can you give us an idea of, you've given an idea of how many hectares are involved in this, and it is substantial, it's enormous, but can you give us an idea of the scale, how many people are affected, how many towns have been engulfed, and indeed, how many people are trying to stop this?
Yeah, so sadly those numbers are pretty high and they're increasing. So in the Camp Fire, which is just north Sacramento, the Chico area, that fire overnight went through the town of Paradise. And so far, as you had mentioned at the top of your program, some 200 people are missing in the Camp Fire. There are 29 fatalities. About 15,000 structures are threatened by it, with about 7,000 homes already destroyed. And then looking further south to the LA area, the fatalities are confirmed at two at this point, 370 homes burned down. The structures that are threatened there are much higher. Over 50,000 homes are threatened. And as I'm sure your listeners are aware, that the town of Malibu has been evacuated.
When it comes to the sort of the scale of the evacuation of the area you've just described, what facilities, what's the infrastructure like in California to deal with something this big?
Certainly there are dozens of evacuation centers that are propping up. I know in the case of the Woolsey fire, those evacuation centers had to be then evacuated themselves, as we're talking nearing hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced by this. And the infrastructure itself is really under dramatic strain, as the highways are blocked up and congested with so many families trying to just leave the area and be in a space that is safe from these wildfires.
One thing that hit the headlines extremely early on in this was the analysis from the president. He said it's poor forest management that has caused or contributed to the rapid spread of these fires. Does he have a point in any way?
The president did come out and tweet that gross mismanagement of the forests are to blame. But as many California fire officials and state representatives have pointed out, it's really unfortunate the president has taken the moment to draw attention to politics and vis-a-vis himself. As Brian K. Rice, the president of the California Professional Firefighters Association, points out, it's really ill-informed and ill-timed, as victims of these fires are still trying to make sense of what remains, because it might be weeks until they're able to return home. And as the LA State Senator Henry Stern points out, that Fires don't respect politics, and he's really begging on the president to pursue a declaration of a major disaster, because that is what we're dealing with here, a natural disaster.
He's reined his comments back in the last few hours. He said, he's retweeted, "The California firefighters and first responders are amazing and very brave. Thank you and God bless you all." Will that do anything to restore any reputation that he might still have in California?
Though that's hard for me to say. He is correct in saying that there are, you know, thousands of firefighters who are out there battling the flames. But to bring it back to force management, it is really problematic to hear it being equated with that, as experts like meteorologists here have pointed out. It's not a dense forest fire situation that we're talking about. We're talking about 70 mile per hour winds that are coming down the mountains and taking to open areas, open fields, brush fires that continue and then take over pretty densely populated areas overnight.
Well, tell us a little bit more about these densely populated areas. What strategy has now been adopted this year by the Californian authorities to ensure that while you might not be able to contain the fire as it spreads at that speed, what you can do is evacuate areas and mobilize districts and authorities faster? Have the Californians done anything differently this time around to make sure that people get out?
Well, the focus has been a lot more on emergency response preparedness and getting the message out. After last year's deadly fires in the Sonoma-Napa Valley region, the state has come under a lot of scrutiny for no singular unified emergency response system. Now, that's still going through its implementation, but the governor has signed into law that by July of next year, there will be a unified emergency response. Until then, it is up to local officials and local counties to issue out these emergency warnings. From a technical standpoint, though, there has been a lot of emphasis on using both public and commercial satellite imaging to look at these fires from above, so to speak, and sort of understand the directions that they might be moving in the areas that could be at risk.
How is California, in terms of its infrastructure, coping with this? I don't mean the emergency infrastructure, but the way that California's houses and areas are being populated. The state has a reputation for having notoriously expensive real estate in cities, yet California is incredibly attractive for people to go and live and work there. What things are being done to ensure that the countryside and the landscape is not being so densely populated that when a wildfire breaks out, the risks to human life are unnecessary?
Yeah, it's tough to say as more folks move here to this area for all of the job opportunities. It certainly does increase demand for housing out in the more rural or country areas outside of San Francisco. As far as infrastructure is concerned, it's a tremendous strain, especially when disasters like this happen at wildfires that seemingly are happening more frequently, and a wildfire season that is lasting longer, because we're talking about a higher cost of living and a higher demand for houses to be built. And if people are still rebuilding after deadly wildfires from last year, it puts a tremendous strain on construction efforts to build more housing for those who have already been evacuated and displaced from their homes.
Daniel Wolfe, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Daily, and a little later on this hour, we pay tribute to a cafe owner who was stabbed in Friday's attack in Melbourne, plus praise for France as it tops our soft power poll. Stay with us.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
What is it like to be a city forgotten and rediscovered? Monocle Films travels to Gunsan in South Korea to bear witness to its urban revival. Here, natives and newcomers are creating quirky bars, art spaces, and a bright future for this charming coastal outpost. Gunsan, building on the past, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
And you're listening to the Monocle Daily. We're live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. The time here is 22:10. It's 23:10 in Ypres. Now, this weekend's commemoration of the centenary of the end of the First World War showed not only the level of sacrifice that men and women of all nations were prepared to make for their country, but also the resolute nature of those determined that such sacrifice should never have to be made again. But there was one man who stole the show, arguably for all the wrong reasons, from his thumbs up to Vladimir Putin to his refusal to visit an American war grave. Donald Trump defied protocol, and with it, it could be argued, an established world order. Someone else, however, decided to step in his place, and we'll find out who that is in just a moment's time. But Florence Biedermann is AFP's bureau chief here in London, and she followed the proceedings this weekend. Welcome back to the studio, Florence. Just before we move on onto how the rest of the world's leaders managed to raise the tone, let's just examine the behaviour of Donald Trump. I mean, it was breathtaking, wasn't it?
Trump is Trump. I mean, of course, there was a bit of scandal around. Like, he started his visit in France by a tweet where he said he was feeling insulted by Emmanuel Macron pleading for European defense. I mean, on his defense, it must be said also that Macron said, "Oh, we have to build our own European defense because we have to be careful with China, Russia, and the United States," like as if it was an enemy. What he meant is that the fact that the United States pulled out of disarmament treaty with Russia was putting Europe in a difficult situation. But, I mean, it was in a list of countries, and I think Trump didn't read further than this line and decided to feel insulted. Okay, that was the first thing. The second, of course, is the fact that he couldn't go to a cemetery for a homage that has been planned well before because of the rain. I mean, citing the fact that his helicopter couldn't land. And, of course, I mean, in everybody's mind, you know, I mean, this First World War was associated with rain, mud, people suffering, blood. I mean, and all this suffering, you know, not acknowledged by someone who pretends, oh, his helicopter cannot land. It has shocked many people in Europe and in America too.
Indeed, I think there was one rather bitter cartoon that had a picture of a trench and the voice of a ghost of one of the First World War soldiers saying, "Lest we forget," and someone another voice appears, "Lest he get wet." It was as simple as that. Was this and the thumbs up given to Vladimir Putin a mere breaking of protocol because Donald Trump either doesn't get or doesn't want to get what needs to be done at such events? Or is this someone who is obviously trying to break the way that things are done?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, obviously, he wants to be different. And that's one of the reasons he was elected, not following the codes, you know, not following the usual manners of the elite. So there is a bit of that. But also, like, it was a bit weird with Putin because they were supposed to meet and to have, like, a talk, like, one-to-one. And then in the end, it didn't happen. So there was kind of sort of some uncertainty on how they would, you know, deal with each other. And in the end, they just talked to each other during a lunch, but that was not really something that was clear from the start, whether they would have a meeting or not.
So we had this line at the commemoration when a third of the world's leaders had gathered to pay tribute at the armistice. And then we have Donald Trump at the front and the rest of the world's leaders unable to hide their feelings when they saw what was going on. At the heart of it, this steely-faced French president who glared at Vladimir Putin.
I hope he's listening to you, Emma, right now.
And he really, really had his face said, "I am determined to make this an event which has dignity." But at the same time, one got the impression that he was very, very much trying to seize the global initiative.
Yes, this is, I mean, the point is that he's kind of the leader of Europe right now, not because he's the only one, but because May is embroiled in Brexit. Merkel has been really weakened in her, I mean, position in her leadership. So he's a little bit the only one to stand up. And certainly, yes, he wanted also, he has, I think, a sense of history, and he wanted this occasion to be really solemn.
One thing that he also did was to begin the inaugural Paris Peace Forum, which is a sort of an echoing of what happened in the immediate aftermath of the 1914-18 war, something that Donald Trump didn't go to. As a result, the Paris Peace Forum, does it do what it is intending to do when you have effectively the leader of the free world saying, no thanks, I'm going elsewhere?
Well, I'm not sure. Even if Trump had attended, it would have had... I mean, I think it was more symbolic than anything else. Just after Macron made a speech where he said, be careful. I mean, what happened in Europe could happen again. So we need peace. We need multilateralism, which was also, of course, a challenge to Trump's vision. So he had somehow to make it a bit more concrete by having people convening. But it was not that anybody really expected something from this meeting in terms of diplomacy. It was just kind of a show of not friendship, but of the fact that Europeans and people could convene together. Putin was at least at the beginning of the meeting.
There is this issue, though, that there's been much said about the fact that the post-war world order was ticking along reasonably well until Donald Trump got into power. And then suddenly things have started to absolutely fragment with the idea that Donald Trump is no longer the leader of the free world. He is the leader of America and America first and to wherever with everybody else. How much is France and Emmanuel Macron able to take on that role?
No, I mean, he cannot be the leader of the world. I'm not sure it started with Trump. I think Trump maybe accelerated or made more obvious things that were cracking before. I mean, is NATO really adapted? And the new threats now are rather like cyber war or spatial war. I mean, there are, of course, some changing, and he's not the one who brought those changes. But the way he puts like his finger on the problems in a way, makes it more obvious.
It also echoes ever so slightly the aftermath of the Second World War, when decisions are made that this will never happen again, and we all know that this leads to the creation of Europe. And France was instrumental in that. I mean, France's historical reputation as being able to bring people together and create new alliances, is that something that we will be able to see in the future with France and Emmanuel Macron, given the fact that he's wobbling at home?
That's something he's desperately trying to do right now. But again, his main partners are not that strong at the moment. So I think it makes it more difficult for France to do that. And yes, in a way, he's answering to Trump. But, you know, he answers to Trump, but he cannot change his stand. I mean, there was this show of friendship between them. By the way, now it has cooled a little bit, as everybody could see in Paris this time. But, you know, it doesn't change Donald Trump's view. So the point is how to answer to this evolution and this situation. But Europe can answer. I mean, it's a bit obvious to say that. Europe can answer only as an institution, like with many countries around, not only with France, of course. And the point is, like when, for example, he's advocating a European defense, I mean, which should be a common project. I mean, this common project has been mentioned like since decades and never really became a reality. So even Macron on his own cannot make something happen that didn't happen before.
Florence Biedermann, thank you very much indeed for joining us. In fact, Florence, you're going to be staying with us because we're now going to turn to Monocle's soft power survey on the Monocle Daily, because we're staying on the topic of political messaging, and the brand new edition of Monocle magazine hits newsstands this next few days. It's filled with seasonal celebrations, but it also, most importantly, has our annual soft power survey. And in this sneak peek of what's in it, Tom Edwards, our editor, guides us through this year's survey with Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. We start by explaining how the winner, France, has been led by Emmanuel Macron and his skills as international messenger.
He's an extraordinary operator when it comes to soft power, whether that's giving Xi Jinping a horse as a gift from the French cavalry to say, this is what we're about, this is how you make friendships, to the way he puts a spotlight on people doing good in his nation. So he knows when to thank somebody who's climbed up a wall and saved a child dangling from a balcony. He knows when to thank an incredibly multiracial football squad who wins the World Cup. He's used all of those elements to burnish the image of France overseas. But he is also a believer in soft power, and he's also a believer in that France can do good in the world and that French culture is something to be championed and to be celebrated at this point.
And I wonder, to again reveal another of the top performing nations, Germany, still at number two, both France and Germany seem to be a bit more traditional in their wielding of soft power, how they wield that influence.
Well, I think, you know, if we're staying with, you know, the government part of this and the diplomatic part of this, certainly many nations around the world are busy flogging their embassies and trying to raise cash for their diplomatic services. Whereas you don't see that with France and Germany to the same extent. Of course, they're keen to run on a budget, but, you know, they're not offloading great buildings, places where they can showcase the trades and crafts of their nation. They're busy using them. And actually, they're both countries where, again, you know, Germany, because of its history, you know, it's not going to be shouting and bellicose about its desires for the world. But both countries are pretty good at that quiet diplomacy as well, of taking someone's ear and telling them what they think. And actually, even that, you know, we saw the extraordinary moments in the meetings between Macron and Trump. Even there, Macron was, you know, the guiding hand, the firm handshake. He may have said some things that have riled Trump since, but he certainly wasn't somebody out there to kind of go shouting about why France was better than everyone else. He wooed by taking Donald Trump and Melania to the Eiffel Tower and taking them to the top to see Paris and show them his city and show them their food culture. That's how he thought you could win friends. And I think it's a very good and reliable format.
Another monocle stalwart, Japan, of course, rounds out the top three. Japan is quite effective at promoting it itself overseas, but not in a heavy-handed way. At times like this, when there's so much talk about putting up walls, building barriers, questioning trade relationships and all the rest of it, I guess all of our top three, and maybe we could talk a bit about Japan, demonstrate it's not just politically expedient to look to the wider world, but it makes financial sense, it makes cultural sense. There's all this other kind of capital you can tap into, and that's still as important as it ever was.
For Japan, you they have an Olympic Games to prepare for. They're using that to lure in talent and architecture talent and all sorts of people to come to Japan. They have an amazing food culture that has travelled to every single nation in the world, often ended up in a fusion with local food. That's something that people can grasp about Japan and an entry point to the nation. The number of tourists there is rising and rising from all parts of the world. When people get there, they're hospitable. They know how to make people feel welcome in their country. They have so many tangible examples of craft, of design, of things being very Japanese when you get there. All of these things sell the country, and it's safe and it's secure. Plus, they're using their might as an industrial engine to build railways and power plants for neighbouring countries such as Vietnam. The caveat that you have to come to, though, is that when it comes down to it, they are not open in the sense of they kind of don't want you to go and live there. They don't want you to pitch up and go looking around for work unless it's in a very contained way. So the migration story, that openness to other cultures, is still a kind of an anomaly in many ways. You know, here's the most welcoming country, but they want to keep their culture as it is. And there is a nationalist element in Japan as well, but it doesn't spoil the story for the country.
And Andrew, I guess just on that point about the freedom of movement of people, of labour, it seems to be a narrative that's universal, good and bad, there's both sides of it. Do you have to try and not allow that to cloud judgment? Because, you know, France, Germany, Japan, all those top three have wrestled with this problem in different ways. It's more immediate elsewhere. This is complicated.
Well, I don't think that we're arguing that if you have open borders and let anybody come in, then you're a great country and you've got great soft power. And that if you have a migration policy and that you stick to it, you're a bad group of people and your power will collapse in the world. But I think it's how you deal with people who are trying to cross your borders and the narrative that you pack around it. So, for example, Australia is a good example. A country that most people feel endeared to. Aussies have a reputation, whether rightfully or wrongly, for being friendly, gregarious, outgoing, welcoming, have a beer, come to the barbecue. It's a stereotype, but it's one that kind of has been very effective for Australia. But the reality for many people who've been trying to reach the country by land, sea, by boat, is that they've ended up in places which don't seem much short of a detention camp, and their human rights have often been challenged in quite questionable ways. And that has stuck to Australia. Even when they've tried to ameliorate their position, when it comes down to it, Australia has a reputation of not being that nice. Now, it may be that they're legally correct and they've done all the right things, but actually for their reputation, it hasn't been good. And that has definitely dented their soft power. Many people say, Australia, super, super nice place, but that sticks to you for a long time.
Andrew, people will probably want to read more. Two things. Remind them. It's all in the December, January issue, of course. And I'm sure you would welcome people, I don't know, dropping you a line personally and telling you what they think of the of your selections, you and your team.
Well, you can certainly write to me if you think that, well, Ireland's in there, Austria's in there, but where? India's in there, but where? Have a look, see what you think. People always have very strong opinions about this. But yeah, the full survey is in the magazine, which is on newsstands in most major cities from this week. And we're giving a little bit of a sneak peek of some of it on monocle.com as well.
Andrew Tuck and Tom Edwards there talking about our latest self-power survey. Well, joining me in the studio still is Florence Biedermann, the French, London Bureau Chief of Agence France-Presse. Florence, congratulations to you and your country. How do you feel to be fated as the representative of the champion of the world champion of soft power?
I'm happy, of course. And, you know, I mean, as you probably know, French tend to be like ranting, depreciating their successes, are not as positive as, you know, as in the Anglo-Saxon culture. So, you know, it's good to have some people, some Anglo-Saxon who tell you you're great, which is not always the case, especially in the UK.
Well, just listening to what Andrew was saying there, that it's this combination, isn't it, that Emmanuel Macron has externally, at least, positioned himself as an individual who has the personal touch. We talked then about him personally rewarding the man who shinned up the side of a building to rescue a toddler. Yet at the same time, he is able to take a stand at armistice and say, patriotism is good. It is a wonderful thing because it is the opposite of nationalism. And it's the idea that a nation can do good. And that's a rare voice at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, the point is, like, he seems to convince abroad. I'm not sure he convinces in the country. But no, certainly he's a clever man. He's a very well-educated man. He studied philosophy also. He has a sense of history. So definitely, I think, yes, in the way he talked about history, like about the fact that the people had to unite, he's good.
There's something about France which is... It sort of seems cyclical and fashionable. I think it was about 20, 30 years ago that French music at least was terrible and seen in the world as being not remotely fashionable. And people thought, well, actually, the French are too rigid. Their ways are too strict. Everybody follows the same routine and the same regime, and the rest of the world became more flexible. And yet, as the rest of the world becomes more fragmented, one often finds there's something curiously comforting about when you go down the streets of Paris, and yes, the lunchtime bistros still serve the same things that they served 25 years ago, but they do it really, really well. And there's a sense of pride in being French that perhaps other nations seem to have perhaps lost sight of.
Yes, there is a sense of pride. I mean, you can also call it chauvinism sometimes. Certainly, there are many nice aspects in the French culture, like the food is one of them, that which you mentioned, which is really important in everyday life. The culture, of course, I mean, it's part of the identity of the country. And also, it is exported all over the world. Also, fashion, perfume, all this luxury industry, like, which is a part of it, too.
And that is something which is incredibly, a very difficult balance that France and its future reputation has to strike, that being open and international and welcoming and reaching out, yet at the same time, there is that issue of chauvinism ever so slightly, that some might call it protectionism, perhaps that's going too far, but there is that feeling that yeah, people are like what they like and it's French.
Yes, I mean, when you say reaching out, I hope this is what they do. I'm not sure it's always the case. Like when you speak English and no French and you're in Paris, sometimes you can have terrible experiences with people who don't speak English or who won't understand you when you try to speak French. But yeah, I mean, it's a balance. You have to be happy of who you are, but you have to try to share it and to explain it to the others too, which maybe French are not that good always at.
Topping this off our survey, but always room for improvement. Florence Biedermann, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. And the latest edition of Monocle magazine, it's a bumper Christmas edition, is out soon. Well, a little later on, we'll be going through the Asian newspaper headlines. But first, at the time at 22:30 here in London, here's a summary of the latest news headlines. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his intelligence officials have listened to a recording of the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He says they're working very closely with Turkey to share intelligence on the case. The Canadian Prime Minister was speaking to reporters in Paris, where he brought up the subject with the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan over the weekend. Mr. Trudeau says he hasn't personally heard the audio, but he's been fully briefed. The Saudi-led coalition has resumed bombing the Yemeni main port city of Hodeidah, and Western allies are pressing Riyadh to end the four-year conflict. It's killed 10,000 people in the impoverished country. Airstrikes against positions of Iran-aligned Houthi rebels halted for more than 12 hours on Monday, but they began again before sunset. Aerial bombardment and raging street battles on the outskirts of the Red Sea city have trapped civilians and threatened hospitals. And Stan Lee has died, the superhero writer and editor behind Marvel Comics. Mr. Lee was one of the masterminds behind some of the most enduring comic book heroes of the 20th century, including Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, and the Hulk. He was a force in the massive success of the industry in the 1960s and 70s. He was 95 years old. This is the Monocle Daily. You're listening to the Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson, and in a little while we'll be getting the Asian newspaper headlines. But first, if you've ever stopped to enjoy a coffee in central Melbourne, chances are you'll know Pellegrini's. It's loved by locals and tourists, and it was one of the first places in Melbourne to install an espresso machine. Well, its owner, Sisto Malaspina, was arguably as well known as the cafe itself was loved. Well, Sisto died on Friday. He was killed by a man wielding a knife who set fire to a car filled with gas bottles and then started to stab people in the street. Sisto will be honoured with a state funeral, no less. The Monocle's own Melburnian Ben Ryland joins me now in the studio. Ben, tell me, who exactly was Sisto Malaspina?
Sisto was a familiar face to many a Melburnian. Indeed, if you've ever frequented the top of Bourke Street, which is quite close to the state parliament, you'll most likely have bumped into him at some point. His was a face that always seemed to be smiling. His restaurant, Pellegrini's, is probably the most iconic coffee shop in Melbourne, certainly the most visually iconic anyway, which, of course, for a city that's so internationally renowned for its coffee is no small feat. That is, of course, largely because Pellegrini's isn't just a product of Melbourne's coffee renaissance, as you might call it. It was actually the cafe that really started it all. Back in the 1950s, when Pellegrini's first opened its doors, Melbourne didn't have a coffee culture really at all, and I don't exaggerate, because in fact, Pellegrini's was one of the very first places in the whole city to install an espresso machine. Now, Sisto had teamed with his friend Nino Pangrazio to take over the business in 1974. And as Melbourne's coffee and food culture really blossomed all around them over the years and decades ahead of them, Pellegrini's has really stood largely unchanged. It always attracts a steady crowd of people, thanks largely to its classic facade, of course. It's very eye-catching as you walk past. It really stands out amongst a lot of the other shops in the area. It's quite a nice area of Melbourne as well, with its big, iconic red blockish letters. I know I say iconic a bit too often, but do you know what? It really does fit that definition perfectly. It's on postcards. It's on all sorts of designs that you can buy about Melbourne, because it really is part of the visual identity.
What's the reaction to his death been like?
Many were quick to point to Sisto's life as a prime example of why Australia's multicultural society is actually so successful. He's someone who not only chose to make Australia his new home, but he also introduced us all to a culture and stories that we might otherwise never have known. Now, look, as the news of this terrible attack on Bourke Street was first reported on Friday, we knew quite early on that one of the victims had passed away. It's important to remember that this is, as I said, a very nice area of Melbourne. It's a very popular area, very, very busy part of the city. It couldn't be more central, and happening during the late afternoon afternoon rush hour. It likely couldn't have been at a more bustling time for the city. So the area that the attack actually took place in is just a couple of blocks down from Pellegrini's. It's right outside the radio station that I used to work for some years ago, Joy 94.9. It was only at the weekend, however, that we really learned that Sisto had been the victim who had tragically passed away as a result of that attack. Now, being such a well-known character of the city, the reaction was one of collective sorrow and sadness. So many well-known Melburnians have been voicing their reactions in the press, on social media. The author Arnold Zabel spoke of how he'd first met Sisto in the 1970s. And even back then, Sisto had always referred to him as Artista, because in Zabel's words, he'd seen potential in Zabel as an author long before he'd even published his first work. The journalist Virginia Trioli, who hosts ABC's breakfast television program at the ABC studios just across town from where this took place, she said that she'd had her first coffee at Pellegrini's and indeed had gone there on her first date as well. Victoria's Attorney General Martin Pakula recalled the last time he'd seen Sisto. He'd served coffee and cake and told him a story about being a nonno, and then refused to let him pay. So many little stories like that, also from regular Melburnians as well. It's not just the celebrities making these stories known. Everyone has really been chiming in. But another well-known voice, the legendary singer Jimmy Barnes, he said he was reportedly in tears when he heard the news. And the actor Russell Crowe echoed some of that as well, posting a tribute on Twitter saying that he'd never visited Melbourne without calling in on Sisto.
Given he was such an enormous figure in Melbourne's cultural scene, how is the city going to be able to pay tribute to him?
Well, the Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews has already offered a state funeral, which Sisto's family has gratefully accepted. Pellegrini's is due to reopen tomorrow or today, if you are listening from Melbourne, Tuesday. It will be serving free long blacks, which was Sisto's coffee of choice. Now, a lone violinist has been seen outside Pellegrini's, in front of an ocean of flowers that stretch all the way around the corner into the lane next door. It is quite a sight to behold, this example of public mourning really going on in the streets of Melbourne. Look, interestingly, it's that very lane right next to Pellegrini's that looks set to be renamed in Sisto's honour. Now, of course, a city like Melbourne, which is so well known for its little laneways that are filled with little coffee bars, it's quite an honour indeed to have one of those lanes actually named after you. Now, that street is currently known as Crossley Street. It connects the main thoroughfare of Bourke Street to its smaller cousin, Little Bourke Street. It's quite a lovely little area of the city. In addition to Pellegrini's, you've also got two of the city's finest bookstores. You've got Hill of Content on one side and the Paperback on the other side, not to mention one of the most loved restaurants of the city as well, Grassi Florentino. Now, look, renaming a street in Melbourne isn't something that happens every day. The state premier has backed the idea, though. Look, to be honest, it really is up to the city council. Now, they have released a statement saying that they'll reach out to the family to discuss the idea and the possibilities when it's appropriate. But look, at this point, suffice to say, there is a lot of grief throughout the streets of Melbourne today.
Now, that ocean of flowers is absolutely beautiful if you've seen pictures of it, but his family have said that they actually want people to give money to charity instead.
That's right. The cafe has asked that people consider donating to the Salvation Army, which is located just across the road from Pellegrini's. There are a lot of flowers being left outside the cafe. You can have a look at the images online. They are just multiplying by the hour, by the moments. They're currently being distributed to nursing homes and hospitals. Sisto was, of course, such a friendly character. His magnetism was really the kind that it becomes part of the city's fabric. It becomes part of the culture. So it really transcends just the walls of the cafe. And I think that's become clear by just so many messages being posted all over the media, all over local television, all over the internet, of people recounting their personal experiences with Sisto. So look, At the end of the day, whether it's a lane named in his honour or simply a wave of donations to the Salvos in his name or simply people continuing to share their stories, Sisto's legacy will certainly be living on.
Monocle's Ben Ryland, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. Stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into The Menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine, and he baked me a potato, and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monocle's programme on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers, and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippie, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. Vegetables, sorry, I said to say carrots, but I love carrots, so I meant vegetables in general.
Time in Beijing is 6:41 a.m. It's 22:41 here if you're listening in London. Let's have a look at what's making the front pages in Asia to help us do all the heavy lifting. In the studio today is Dr. Igor Rogelia, who's a teaching fellow at the China Institute at King's College London, currently on secondment to Florence. So thank you very much indeed for, I'm assuming, flying back especially to do the paper review. Igor, it's very good to see you. Right, what have you spotted?
I've got a couple of stories. Two of them are actually on labour issues. The first one is from China, but this is published actually in the Japan Times. Of course, a story like this wouldn't necessarily get published in a Chinese print media. Essentially, what's been happening is that in the past days, quite a lot of young Chinese labour activists have started to go missing, been arrested and so on. And the article actually lays out that this is a group of people that had tried to help organise a trade union. And you might think, surely China is a communist country, should allow trade unions. You'd be surprised that, in fact, no. There are trade unions, but they're all, of course, controlled by the party.
Indeed, you don't really necessarily encourage dissent or wanting to change certain orders, in which case one wonders what on earth these labour activists were doing by organising this union.
This is sort of a small but quite a growing movement in China, which is sort of left-wing radical students which are trying to organise groups in support of workers who perhaps have had their rights trampled upon, but also other issues from environment, gender equality and so on. So it's kind of like progressive left-wing activism seems to have sort of riled up the party a little bit and they've decided to send a message and crack down on it.
How much is this actually going to have a chilling effect on people who wish to join to create unions?
I think it will. I mean, that's sort of a common tool, I suppose, that the Chinese Communist Party uses is to sort of crack down very hard on those people who cross the line in order to deter future people from doing the same.
But one thing that this this article has highlighted, in fact, is the fact that other countries, other institutions in different places are at liberty to cut ties with Chinese institutions if they decide to treat their people undemocratically. Now, this has happened in this case, hasn't it?
That's right. Yeah, I mean, this is Chinese universities are becoming let's say, more strictly under the control of the party. And this has led to a couple of Western institutions to cut ties. Most recently, Cornell, who had a tie-up with Renmin University in Beijing, cut ties. But also, let's say, Beijing University has also gotten a new boss who was a former security chief. And again, lots of Western institutions are questioning about their links with Chinese universities.
What's interesting, though, is that so many students go from China to the universities outside of the country. They must see a whole different system going along and experience freedoms which they would only dream of in China. What does Chinese students do in that situation when they go away, they have a taste of freedom and then they go back?
Well, I mean, there's lots of different stories, I guess. Some people are not very impressed with the West, and especially how universities function, being, you know, quite dysfunctional. But I think what happens to a lot of people is indeed, especially those who remain in academia, is that, you know, obviously in China there are limits on what you can and cannot say, what can and cannot be published, and so on. And especially for, I guess, younger people, you know, they're really, you know, trying to push the boundaries here of what you know, perhaps could be done. But, you know, some of them, of course, will end up getting arrested and getting in trouble for this. So,
okay. Yeah. Let's have a look at the Straits Times now. Alibaba has another big Singles Day, but the party may not last. Singles Day, November the 11th, it's an idea that the Chinese, that actually Alibaba came up with about 11 years ago, isn't it? And the whole point is to not just celebrate being a singleton now, it's just a shopping frenzy.
Yes, it's a kind of a consumerist orgy in China. So
that sounds so much more fun than I suspect it actually is.
I mean, you know, it's one of these things that obviously it's become a focus, you know, for retailers to try and get as many people out and spend and so on. But it has become a little bit of a sort of cultural institution as well in China. It's kind of an opportunity for young people to go out. Lots of people go out partying and so on. And even though it's called Singles Day, people have started, have taken to celebrating it as a sign of kind of also romantic relationships as well. Apparently lots of people get married on Singles Day, which doesn't really make sense, but there you go.
Oh, well, let's not worry about tradition, hey? The interesting article in the Straits Times, though, is that it immediately says that, yes, there has been that. Would you describe it? A consumerist orgy. Glorious. But it says, this time the party was held with icebergs in sight from the deck. What's gone wrong, Igor?
Well, I mean, there's a list of things, but number one on the list would be the trade war with the US. This is really slowly getting into the Chinese economy, and then growth rates have begun to slow. So the big fear is that Chinese consumers would also start worrying about this. So it's not so much about, let's say, the effects already being felt. It's more about consumers becoming more cautious, perhaps not, you know, being quite as generous, and you know, sort of clutching onto their purses and pocketbooks.
What does that say about the health of the Chinese economy? Because we are always told that it is buoyant, that it is growing steadily at, what, 6.5% each single year, and will never change that way. But there has been this excessive amount of focus on Chinese consumerism, hasn't there? Are we seeing any changes in it?
I think the important thing here is to remember that domestic consumption is meant to be the core way in which the Chinese economy moves from being this kind of heavy polluting manufacturing heavy economy to being a modern developed economy with, you know, sort of a healthy domestic consumption. So any signs of a slowdown here are met with a lot of worry, of course.
What's interesting in this article is it says that Alibaba's shares have actually dropped by almost a third in the last 4 or 5 months. What's precipitated such a huge change? Because were that to happen to any other retailer, I think the world would be going into flat spin.
Yeah, I think the issue with Alibaba is that, of course, it is one of the world's largest retailers. It is probably the only competitor that Amazon will ever have. However, it's sort of disappointed on a couple of things. The kind of results in terms of profits have not come about. I mean, this is often the case with online retailers. We know also it took forever for Amazon to become a profitable enterprise. I mean, I think it's probably the same thing for Alibaba. But I think there's another element here which Amazon doesn't have to contend with, which is the political situation. And I think in the last years, the Chinese government has become more let's say, involved in the functioning of China's IT market.
Indeed. Let's move to the Chosun Ilbo, an astonishing, shocking story here. North Korean slave labourers in Poland paid $27 a month. How is that possible?
Yeah, so this is a part of a wider problem with posted labour, with posted workers, because essentially what happens is that these are people who work for North Korean companies that are hired wholesale in Poland, but especially in Russia, and these North Korean companies that then decide what the workers get paid. Mainly how it works is that the workers are charged a lot of sort of fees for things like boarding and food and so on. This is a way for North Korea to gain a lot of foreign currency, the North Korean regime being famously starved of foreign exchange currency. So one export that North Korea has are these workers who then work in dreadful conditions. Mainly it's people who work in construction, welders and so on.
It's astonishing stuff, and one wonders how on earth that is allowed to take place. Finally, let's have a look at This Week in Asia. Green gold rush. Thailand and Malaysia race to legalise medical marijuana.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those stories that's quite surprising because, as you know, I think anyone who's ever been to let's say Thailand or Singapore, you know, even just arriving at the airport, you met with these giant signs saying, you know, the penalty for trafficking drugs is death and so on. So there is, on one hand, a very, very strict legal system which has a very grim view on any kind of narcotics trafficking and so on. On the other hand, though, at least in Thailand and Malaysia, there's been a realization that there's potentially a big market here for medical marijuana use.
And how is this going to work in, nations which take such a prohibitive view towards controlled drugs, at least?
For now, I think a lot of it is done through very strict licensing. So it's about sort of having farms which have licenses to grow this. And it's about, you know, sort of ensuring that the state has control over it. And this is, you know, the article clearly says that on one hand, you do have support for this kind of liberalization in Thailand and Malaysia. But China, South Korea, Japan, and especially Singapore are sticking to their guns, saying that there's absolutely no way.
Indeed. What does this do for the likes of Malaysia? You know, they've just, as this article says, has recently scrapped the death penalty for all crimes. To make such a huge stance about legalised drugs, legalised medical marijuana at once, how much does it influence the rest of the region?
I think it will influence in that once... if it is proven indeed that this is a good business and if, you know, sort of it's clear that, let's say, recreational use does not follow from medical use in countries like Malaysia and Thailand, this might set an example for other countries to actually also have slightly more, less restrictive policies.
Igor Regalia, thank you very much indeed for bringing us the Asia newspapers. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. With progress towards peace on the Korean Peninsula unpredictable to say the least, it's the smaller gestures which arguably can bring around more tangible results. 200 tonnes of tangerines are being sent from the south to the north. It's in exchange for a shipment of mushrooms. Well, to explain all, I'm joined in the studio by John Everard, the former ambassador to Pyongyang and expert in all things grocery this evening. thank you very much indeed for joining us, John. Good to see you. So tell us all about these tangerines and these mushrooms.
Yes, the tangerines, of course, gives fruitful diplomacy a whole new dimension of meaning, doesn't it?
That's very sweet of you.
The mushrooms, to start all off, are very special mushrooms, very delicious mushrooms, and are found in almost only in North Korea. Very valuable, and that Kim Jong-un gave Moon Jae-in 2 tons of these when the two met at the Pyongyang summit back in September.
For personal consumption, surely not, or for distribution among whom?
Amongst close friends, I imagine. Yes, 2 tons of mushrooms. You'd get pretty sick, even with very good mushrooms, wouldn't you? And so the South Koreans would be sitting around scratching their heads, thinking, oh, you've got to reciprocate the gift. We don't have special mushrooms this side of the DMZ, but we do have tangerines, which don't really grow in the north. It's a bit chilly up there. But in Jeju Island, in the south, semi-tropical, you can get tangerines. So 200 tons, so 100 times the weight of the mushrooms in tangerines going north. In army freight aircraft, I'm not quite sure whether this is the first time that South Korean army freight aircraft have ever landed at Pyongyang Airport. And with them comes the Ministry of Unification, just to make the gesture. Now, the big question now is, what does the north do with 200 tons of tangerines? OK, Kim Jong-un has to keep lots of people happy, and a lot of them will grace party tables. But it'd be nice to think that most North Koreans at least get some taste of the tangerines this time around.
Well, it is interesting that you say this, because when you think of North Korea and the diet there, it is a country which has a reputation for letting its people go hungry. So these 200 tonnes, will they all be kept for a select few, or will there be the slightest chance that an average citizen in Pyongyang or even outside the capital will be able to taste such a delicious thing?
Well, I think there's a chance. I'm not quite sure how big a chance that is. I think the thing to watch for is whether they suddenly appear in the markets around Pyongyang, whether you can just go and buy them. I think it'd be too much to hope for the impoverished North Korean state just to hand them out. Not only do a lot of North Koreans go hungry, there's great food insecurity, but the diet is terrible. So all the vitamins, especially the vitamin C in tangerines, might do a few people a lot of good.
It's an interesting thought, actually, that when you're trying to promote peace and almost involve, you know, not necessarily hope for regime change, but for hope for the softening of authority when it comes to the likes of Kim Jong-un, to think that he will be able to now control people's loyalty almost by inspiring them, say, if you're nice to me, well, I will give you something back like a humble tangerine. He could, in fact, actually get people to become more loyal to him because of this little citrusy fruit he's got.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, it's a completely bizarre form of political control, isn't it? I mean, Mao Zedong once said that political power goes out of the barrel of a gun. Kim Jong-un reckons it grows off a tangerine tree. Well, it's some improvement, I suppose.
This is a gentle and neat circumvention of tight, very, very tight sanctions, isn't it? How is this being allowed to happen?
It's all food, and food is excluded from the sanctions.
Simple as that.
Simple as that.
Absolutely,
yes.
Fine. How often do we see this happening between the North and the South? This is a high-profile gesture. You give me mushrooms, I'll give you tangerines. But in terms of the things that are being exchanged over the North and South Korean border, we get the impression that there's absolutely nothing and something is offered and then it's withdrawn. But are there these little things that are happening on a regular basis?
I wouldn't say a regular basis. This is not the first time. I think it's the first time we got in for mass fruit deliveries in quite this way. But we've had canine exchanges before. Remember that Moon Jae-in is the proud possessor of 2 rather fine Pongsu dogs, which are very special dogs to North Korea, given to him in person by, not actually Kim Jong-un, but by Kim Jong-un's sister. And it'll be interesting to see how they reciprocate that. Last time such dogs were given to a South Korean president, they replied with Jindo dogs, which are a special South Korean breed, 2 Jindo dogs called Peace and Reunification. How's that for a hint?
That's a bit difficult to shout when you're in the park. Briefly, in your experience as an ambassador, what have countries given to other countries off the top of your head that make you think that's in the tangerine category?
Wow. I think the best answer to that is to invite any listener who can to go and wander around the Hall of Gifts to the great leaders of North Korea, where they receive the most bizarre gifts from all kinds of places. My personal favourite is a slightly wobbly papier-mâché crocodile from Nicaragua holding out a tray of drinks. That's out there with tangerines.
That sounds pretty useful to me. I've got one in my lounge. John Everard, thank you very much indeed for being our diplomatic and citrus correspondent. That's all we have time for today's edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our producers, Daniel Bache and Ben Ryland, and our researchers, Daphne Karnizes and Marta Libri. Our studio manager was George McDonough. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time. Georgina Godwin is your host for that. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that edition from 2200 London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.